Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I guess we're all pretty much recovering from the latest edition of the James Beard Foundation Awards, held, of course, in Chicago, which it has been for the last several years.
They're going to start calling them the Rahm Emanuel Memorial Awards.
Yes. But and we're going to be talking mainly, I think, about the Chef and Restaurant Awards. The Media Awards took place earlier and in New York City. But it was a very different kind of event this year in many ways, starting with the theme, which was rise. And it could be rise in whatever context you wanted. You could do your own sign, actually, rise for whatever. And it tended to center on such major issues that facing the food industry as sustainability, accountability, hunger relief, these kinds of things. So it was very serious.
Don't forget the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room, me too.
Right. Well, I was going to get to that.
You were going to get to that.
Yeah, I was getting to that because for the first time ever, the actual foundation issued a notification to the jurors to take into account with their nominations the character of the chef or restaurateur that they were nominating, which was an unheard of thing, but they had to sort of weed out, shall we say, some of the more notorious actors, bad actors on the scene. So as a result, we had some the results were rather amazing. We had heavy leverage for winners for women chefs, as well as persons of color. This was unheard of. I think it was 9 out of 11 women or persons of color in the winner list, which is amazing. It usually is all white guys. It is.
As a white guy, I don't feel like I've been
oppressed. Well, you know it's wrong. So, the stroll around dinner, actually, they took the chefs were people who had gone through the James Beard Boot Camp, which addresses these heavy duty issues. Anyhow, but we won't get into that. Let's look at some of, because you're anxious to talk about some of the winners. I mean, astoundingly, after how many nominations, we finally have Frank Stitt's Highland Bar and Grill getting an award.
For best restaurants. It's one of the two top awards, and very well earned over a very long time of serving the Birmingham community and drawing diners from all over the world.
Well,
because his cuisine is so fine.
Yep.
Then there was a greedy guy, Eduardo Jordan, who wasn't satisfied with one.
He got two. Yeah.
Because he was rising star chef and best chef.
He's such a nice guy.
I had the opportunity to interview him last fall.
Yeah, it's on our website.
Really, 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 really nice guy. And
we went to his workshop the Star Chefs
on how to fix chitlins.
Chitlins, yeah, I didn't believe he was doing it, but he did.
And he said, yeah. And he said, if you come to my restaurant and you don't like chitlins, you're going to be very disappointed. who are some more of them?
Another person who has had I don't know how many nominations Gabrielle Hamilton from Prune. And first of all, she's a woman, and she won Outstanding Chef, like of all the chefs in the whole United States. And, of course, you only win this once. You're not eligible for the next year. But I love Gabrielle because she's not only a very, very good chef, but she's also a very talented and inspired writer, and she writes on food. She's produced a couple of books and so forth.
Well, you got it.
But she has only one restaurant. Usually these people have multiple restaurants, but she has one and it's good. And it indicates how much influence she has had in the chefing world.
Now you've got a couple of lady chefs that you really admire, winning the two probably the most difficult awards to win, Best Chef New York and Best Chef West, which includes San Francisco.
Let's
hear it from Missy Robbins, who hasn't. I think she's won it before. And she does magic with pasta. For Michelle, for Dominique Chen from her namesake restaurant.
Dominique Chen from.
In San Francisco.
She has three places, I guess, right? But I think this was for her flagship.
Yeah, absolutely.
We
interviewed her when she was still in the final planning stages of opening that restaurant, and we knew it was going to be great.
I mean, I don't understand why she still has only two Michelin stars. She's a three Michelin star person if I ever saw her.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, but anyhow, so I was very happy with a lot of these winners, actually.
It's nice to see people who are not the name chef, but obviously are the ones behind the range night after night. So we love Joanne Chang and her husband from their restaurants in Boston. But their chef from their fine dining restaurant, Myers and Chang, won for Best Chef Northeast. I thought that was pretty good.
Yes. No, I mean, to clarify something, it's from the Highland Bar and Grill that the winner actually is the pastry chef, and that is that's a national award, so that's not a Southern award. I mean, that's a much stiffer competition.
I thought he won Best Restaurant, not best pastry, but I could be wrong there. You have the list in front of you.
Well, he also got, the restaurant, Island Bar and Grill, got Outstanding Restaurant.
That's what I meant.
And some of these people I actually don't know at all, but I mean, some have been, they've been around for such a long, I was thrilled that our buddy Mike Latta won for,
another one. He's probably only got one left now, which is Best Service Award.
Yeah.
And he'll be done. He'll have swept the table.
Yeah, and of course we still have representation from Zahoff in Philadelphia, which is a great restaurant.
Yeah, and again, that's a great recognition that a person is cooking every day.
A place we've enjoyed a lot is Fat Rice in Chicago.
And
we had Abe Conlon, who we've interviewed before.
How did they choose between Abe and his wife? I mean, they both worked together.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe that was just one for the guys, just to make him satisfied.
Well, he's the chef, and she does front of the house.
Oh, she does front of the house. Okay, there you go. And then, of course, they're in Chicago.
I'm going to get a lot of flack for this, a Manhattan outpost in Minneapolis. Gavin Kaysen, who used to work for Daniel Boulud in New York City, and then everyone thought he was nuts. He took off for Minneapolis and opened his restaurant Spoon and Stable to great acclaim.
So there you have it.
There's many more.
Well,
too,
I know there's enough 53 million more awards.
Well, let me say one more thing.
We do have other things to put in the program.
Everybody got really excited about the Humanitarian of the Year Award,
right.
Which actually they gave out in advance of the gala. And he's been winning all of them across the board.
Larger than life, Jose Andres, just not to keep you in suspense anymore.
Yeah, Jose Andres, and he fed most of Puerto Rico, of course. In fact, he fed all of Puerto Rico, as I understand it. But now he's called upon to every major natural disaster to feed everybody. But he's so expansive.
And then just to finish up, Paula Wolfert from down Texas way was recognized by this American who's who, right?
Right.
Oh, no. She was something else.
Who are you talking about?
Paula Wolfert.
Oh, Paula, oh, Lifetime Achievement. Oh, that's well-deserved, boy. I forgot about that.
Absolutely.
That is certainly well-deserved.
Okay, so anyway, let's take a break and we'll resume the program as normal.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Oh, welcome back. For years, I oogled, I think that's the word, oogled this grand display of cheese. Forever Cheese is the brand at the Fancy Food Show in New York City. But I looked into the background, the history of this company, and they had the 20th anniversary, which really got me going. And we set up an interview, which I thoroughly loved, with Michelle Buster, who's a principal in that company and co-founder of that company. And it was wonderful sampling the cheeses that she thought were, she's picked out as very special, and they were. And I mean, it's a fascinating story. What a great life.
It really is. And an amazing business has grown from nothing to 500 cheeses or something like that. Really.
200, but she also has accompaniments.
Absolutely amazing achievement.
20 years, yep.
Here's Michelle.
Michelle, I said to you just a few minutes ago, and I'll say it again, that your company is really so amazing. I have a gazillion questions to ask about it. And about you, Michelle Buster, is it?
Buster.
Yes, and your company is Forever Cheese.
That's right.
Yeah, and you have so many wonderful products. Let's go back to the beginning. How did you start this?
It was all by accident. I was living in Rome. I was working in sports. And I didn't have a place to live. And by chance, there was a group of guys who walked into my hotel and invited me to go out with them that night. One of those people was a gentleman who I eventually started dating, and his family owned a cheese company in the countryside of Rome.
You're kidding.
So as a, I'm not going to say how old I was because then we can do the math.
Right.
But as a woman who had been single for a while and loving traveling the world, I really liked this guy, but after 1 year of living apart, because ironically, he went to travel and study, not travel, but work in the States. He was kind of helping his father with some things for the business, but mainly perfecting his English. And I was still doing sports with the long distance and said, okay, let's give this a shot. So I moved back to the States, and I was supposed to work with World Cup Soccer.
The New York office
was still forming and not quite ready. And in order to make money, because I'm in New York and I can't just do nothing, I was a data processor. But I didn't want to do that forever. And listening to Pierluigi always speak about the company and his frustrations with his importers, eventually I just said, well, why don't we do it? And why don't I help you? You teach me cheese, and I will put the cheese where it needs to go.
Aren't you wonderful? So that's it.
Well, that makes it sound really easy, but
no. Anything having to do with importing, and especially importing any foodstuff into the United States, is not easy. I know that.
And especially cheese.
Yes.
We'll talk about rules in a little bit.
Because it wasn't the rules that were all that difficult then. It was the other stuff.
What other stuff are we talking about?
Well, we have one cheese to start with,
right,
the Fulvi Pecorino Romano, which was iconic for not just the company. At that point, it was called Fini Fulvi. But it was iconic because it was one of the very few remaining types of Pecorino Romano cheeses still produced in the countryside of Rome. So to get that message across, person by person, store by store, took a really long time. And we were covering, well, eventually we covered a whole country. I physically covered the entire country.
Wow.
And then we had from one cheese to four cheeses. So just getting that message about Pecorino Romano is different in Rome or Sardinia. Sheep's milk cheese in a time where people were scared if you told them milk was from sheep's milk.
Right.
So that and many other things, it was a very long, challenging, and turned out rewarding road.
Now, your friend's company was a producer or a dealer?
My partner, it was his family's company. His uncle was the cheesemaker at the Fulvi cheese plant.
Oh,
his
wow.
father ran the company. And as the son, he was helping with the interest in the States, going back and forth until I confused the issue.
Okay, so they were cheesemakers. They were artisanal cheesemakers.
Exactly.
So then you decided, obviously, to do something different, so you expanded the product line that you represented. How did you go about doing that?
Well, I mean, first it was just the family's cheeses. That was the only focal point we had for a number of years. And in the process, at the beginning, since I had lived 3 years in Spain, I was very much in love with Spain, even though I had also lived in Rome. So I never lost sight of my love for Spain. So I kind of made a deal at the beginning. And I said, Pierluigi, I'll help you and your family, you know, realize this vision, and I'll work tirelessly to make sure that we introduce your family's cheese. But if we're successful, at some point you need to give me the go-ahead to go to Spain and find a manchego that is really good and exciting so we can bring it to the States and share it with the American public.
Fair.
And then little by little, we would just kind of, oh, we like this cheese, so we feel confident enough, we'll add another Italian cheese. And, oh, we'll add another one of these. And at some point around 1995, Gianluigi said, okay, I think things are going well. Go find your manchego. But I didn't know it would take me almost 2 years to fall in love with what I consider to be the iconic manchego. But along the way, I found another cheese, which has become very well known in our country today, what we call the drunken goat.
Oh, yes, that's very popular, yeah. True.
Now you've got more as well.
Yeah, you have now over 200 cheeses, and the way you hit our radar was you were celebrating your 20th anniversary.
Exactly. It's not really hard to believe, but it's super exciting for us because after some years with the family business, we just decided to do something with a different focus in the way that when we were with the family's company, nobody really understood we were a cheese company. So we formed a company called Forever Cheese so people could pronounce us finally. And because from Cini Fulvi, nobody could ever really understand what we were saying. They couldn't spell it, and it usually ended up sounding like Cini Folding, and they thought we made cardboard boxes. So we were so happy that people knew we did cheese. But like I'm sure you got, I saw you got an array of really fun products. Almost immediately after changing the name and starting to know that we were a cheese company, we started doing things that were also not cheese. Because we had this idea that in Europe, when you enjoy cheese, you usually enjoy it with some dried fruits, with some honey and some others. And we thought that we should bring that custom more strongly to the U.S.
Okay,
so it was very anecdotal that we then were Forever Cheese, dot, dot, dot. Because, yes, we have probably close to 500 products right now, which really even surprises myself.
So this is where the fabulous Marcona almonds come from?
The Marcona almonds was something that I looked for 10 years before I knew what they were called. I ate them as a student, and it was stuck in my mind, and I'd come back to the States. I'd try every type of almond I could find, and I was like, I don't like these. Why do I like them in Spain, and I don't like them in the States? And I was on a trip to the region of Murcia with some customers.
Right, right.
It was 1997. And they took me to an almond grower. And I finally asked my question to somebody who could answer it. And they taught me that there was hundreds of varieties of almonds. I don't know why I didn't think about it, but, you know, growing up, you kind of had the one kind of apple or two, and you didn't really think that there could be 40 varieties.
Yeah, so you know what the almond growing capital of the world is?
California.
Exactly.
The
but not Marcona.
No, but the whole almond market for pricing and availability is based on the California almond.
Yes.
So if there's a scarcity of California almonds and the price shoots up, that affects us greatly in Spain. But I was so happy to find the name of it. And I had a group of retailers who said, we'll buy them if you bring them. Because as you know, the Marcona almond costs about 12 times what a California almond costs.
That
is so different. It was that sweetness, the way that they did it, you know, the fried and just so beautiful.
Now, I have a really basic question, Michelle, is, I mean, where did you develop such a really fine palate? Because that's what's carried your company. You might be smart about marketing or importing and exporting, but it's this palate that you bring when you're researching the products you're going to handle. Where did that come from?
Thank you very much for that.
It's true.
It's super ironic. I grew up and I ate nothing as a kid. I liked nothing but peanut butter. So I think it was just something innate inside me, besides having what some people in the industry told me is that I have an eye for them. I mean, the basis of our line are things that we, both my partner and I, but I'm very much in the forefront of looking for things, what I'm passionate about. I have to be crazy loving it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just that gut feeling. It's just that love and wanting to share it and sharing it and educating people and bringing it and putting it in people's mouths that I know I need to make everyone else fall in love with it if I want to have it here.
Wow. And now it's really funny. The Marcona almonds come from Valencia. You have another treat from Valencia, which I wolfed them down in no time. That's the cashews salted
chocolate.
And
oh, and the piedras de luna.
Oh, my God, they're wonderful.
He ate them all.
Oh, my God. Well, I love cashews almost as much as I love Marcona almonds.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Marconas actually are grown in Catalonia, in Valencia, in Murcia, kind of in a number of different regions. I just happen to have some producers in Valencia, and I have some in Murcia, that some are growers and some are friers, so that I have a well-rounded
right.
and enough of a source. The piedras de luna come from my love for chocolate and salt.
Yes.
We were selling another product called piedras de chocolate, which are cocoa-dusted chocolate largueta almonds from Spain, and I wanted another one to go with it, and I figured if we did something with cashews, they could be amazing. So my producer presented me with something, and I said, it's missing something. Add salt. And then they just became one of those addictive, phenomenal. I steal some of them from my own warehouse, from our sample room, every time I go.
I'm thinking back to when we were in Valencia, and one of the things, there were many things that fascinated me, but one of the most fascinating was when the music performances were over in the concert hall, they used to turn on lights, and they would light up the fountains and play music, and the fountains would dance to the music.
That sounds amazing, and I have to be honest, I've never gotten to go to a concert there in all my years of going.
It's the fountains are right in the riverbed.
It's on the other side of the river from where I usually am. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go back to talking about cheese, since Forever Cheese is where we started out.
Every cheese will have a story, and we sampled a variety of yours, and Peter wants to know
I wanted to ask a question first of all, because surely one of the challenges must be getting it from the cheesemaker to the United States. I mean, that's not a trivial exercise.
Is it just part of
what you learned how to do?
Yes, it was a really interesting, challenging, heart-wrenching, frustrating battle in a lot of cases. If I tell you that in our first years, even from our own cheese plant in Italy, we'd spend hours in the cooler on the weekends repacking cheeses. Maybe the vacuum seal had blown up and we had to pull that out, redoing things. The cartons might not be the right way because there's so many little details, not just from the way the cheese comes, from whether you have to vacuum seal it or whether you put a paper or you can leave it on its own. The type of box you use, if that box absorbs condensation or holds it in and causes mold, how you stack it, and then just the natural evolution of the cheese for the type that it might be, if it gets here too aged, if it gets here too ripe. And then there's so many people, I would just trip over cheese. I mean, there's not one way that we would find them. Some at the beginning came from our plant that made them. Some we would be at a restaurant and find one and just say, hey, can you get the phone number of this cheese maker? And I'd call them on the phone and say, what do you think about selling to the U.S.? And they, of course, want to, but neither of us knew what that actually meant. So you might have numbers of shipments where you have to throw product out, or where it suffered, or where it cracked, or where everything was great until one day it wasn't great. Because all of those cheeses are like, I always call them, they're like children.
Yes.
Each one is individual. You have good hair days, you have bad hair days. Some are more aged than others. So much can happen that it's really an art to learn how to do it well for each different cheese, to know the right aging point that you want it to leave. And some things, honestly, I could never figure out, as much as both the cheesemaker and I wanted so much for their cheese to be here. It just wasn't meant to be.
Now, let's start with the one that we began with, because we love soft cheese and we love goat cheese. So we started with the Nocetto di Capra from Lombardia near Bergamo, which we know. And it was so absolutely, incredibly, deliciously scrumptious.
Thank you. That cheese that now comes into perfection, honestly, was quite challenging to start with. Sometimes you saw that beautiful, bloomy mold that came on the rind. Yes. Sometimes it would come in bald. Sometimes that white mold would be mingled with green. Sometimes it was too firm. So it was trial and error with the producer and the ager to get it so that it came to us and was always so unctuous and gooey in the right way. And then when you kind of like play with it, I like to play with my cheese and you just kind of like squeeze it a little bit and there's some pliability, yet it's not too soft so that it doesn't just go splat out. So that was a wonderful plus that we've gotten it. And I just came back from visiting that producer, and it was really exciting because most of the time we're so excited and pleased to tell you that we know all of our producers. We don't have middlemen, but I'm going there all the time, or Pierluigi's going there all the time. But in this case, since they work with an ager, I hadn't quite made it to see them yet. But literally 2 weeks ago, I met Giampiero and got to see how they made this fantastic cheese.
Okay, now this second one we started is called L'Ubergier Piscine. I'm sure I'm brutalizing the pronunciation.
No, I think you did a pretty good job.
But that's a Toma. Now, is Toma a style of cheese?
Yes. You find it very often in the area of Piemonte, and you find it in France as well.
Yes,
so it's like it's a round wheel of cheese, generally just 4 to 6 inches. in diameter, something like that, but it could be semi-soft, it could be semi-firm. In a way, it reminds me of when you go to central and southern Italy, or and you have cacciotta, little wheel of cheese, but they could be cow, goat, sheep, anything else. Now, generally, when you find Toma, it's generally a cow's milk cheese.
Now, the interesting thing, before I forget, because I do forget things, the most surprising source of Toma that we've ever come across is the Point Reyes Cheese Company in California.
Yes, they make really terrific
cheese. They make all blue cheese except this one, Toma, which is delicious. So if you want some cheese that doesn't have 4,000 sea miles on it, give the gals at Point Reyes a call.
I was able to go there a couple years ago when I went out for the Fancy Food Show. It was
okay,
really beautiful
great.
There.
Now the next one we're on to is the one that has the paprika on it.
Well, I wanted to just say on the Lubergère, it comes from Piemonte, and one of the most unusual things about this cheese, besides that it's family-run and they have 100 Brunel Pinot cows, is that it's a raw cow's milk cheese, and it's coagulated with thistle flour. So it's vegetable rennet. And that
Very
was the first cow's milk cheese that I had ever met that was coagulated with thistle.
Yeah, I never would have thought of it.
I thought that was really interesting, actually.
Did you get that nice floral part to it?
Yeah.
It was just very smooth and very floral, and it's really accessible. And it was a great find. That was one of those things that I was running to get out of the rain from the cheese show at Bra, and I saw this tent, and I ducked into it just so I wouldn't get soaking wet. And when I looked, they kept trying to feed me their beer cheese. And I looked closer, and I saw this simple Toma with vegetable rennet, and I said, this is the one I'm interested in. We now do their whole line, but that was, I was so excited because I love to find and learn about new things.
Well, the one we're on to now is called Alicios, and it's from the Canary Islands.
Oh, that one. I thought you were talking about Barricato.
Well,
Alicios.
We finished the Berger. We finished that one. We haven't started the Barricato yet.
We decided to go
with the Canary Island one next. I don't really know why.
Well, it's perfect. Maybe because I'm in Connecticut, and I'm just two towns over from the producer's wife's. She has a family member living in New Haven.
Really?
Okay. And
I was talking to her before I came here because if I had time, I wanted to look him up. But Alicios is a brand new cheese for us in the U.S. It's a cheese that I found just under a year ago, and when I tasted it, the ones I've always had have been 100% Canary Island goat, which the goats have really nice, rich milk. It's quite a tall goat, very mottled. And what I loved in this cheese, it had 70% cow's milk, 30% goat, but it was still so flavorful. It had great notes of kind of grass, some salt, but the right amount, and I thought it was just so balanced and so accessible. And that rind that you see comes from the way palm leaves used to be intertwined together to form the rind.
Okay.
And so that's why they use that rind now, and I think it's super beautiful. And I also visited them for my first time. I had never been to the island of Fuerteventura, and I was there in February. So it was quite amazing to see these thousands of goats run around, come in, get milked. And then I went to see the production, and I'm super excited that you got that cheese. The name is in Spanish for the trade winds that blow over the Canary Islands.
Okay, got it. Interesting. Now, have you ever met the people from Neil's Yard in London?
I have.
We had them on the program, you remember?
Mr.
and Mrs. Percival.
Yes, I get to see them at Bra and at certain other events.
There you go.
Cheese related.
Well, you're doing a wonderful job, just as the Neil's Yard people are doing a wonderful job in my native land. And keep it up. The only thing that I'm looking for now is you gotta send me a blue cheese.
That's easy.
You gotta send me a blue cheese. I just adore blue cheese.
How strong? Do you want mild and milky? Do you want kind of Stiltonish in texture? Do you want really piquant and a little bit spicy? What kind do you like?
Best one out there that I've come across recently is Stichelton, which is the raw milk version of Stilton.
I have seen it. I have some friends who sell it.
Yeah, that's really good. So that gives you an idea of the style. And we like Gorgonzola.
My favorite story, though, is the Italian guy who found it.
Oh, Rogue Creamery.
And Rogue Creamer, he smuggled the Roquefort mold over to the United States. Did you know that story?
David's amazing. I actually didn't know the story, but
well,
I know the man.
This is the guy that had this. This is the old Italian guy.
This is the old guy who started the Rogue Creamery.
He's the one who smuggled the mold.
Oh, that's so funny. That's great.
There's so many stories in cheese and in chocolates. You know, it's very exciting for you to be involved with all of this.
I learned that, you know, it's been the most rewarding part of everything has been to see how we can impact the lives of all of the producers that we work with. I get goosebumps every time I think of it because I've watched a lot of the people flourish. And there was a lot of years that Spain and Italy were in really bad crises, but yet our producers prevailed. And I felt like we were really doing something very special. And, I mean, I have to be honest, when I started in the cheese industry, it wasn't as in as it is today. And people used to raise their eyebrows when I said I sold cheese for a living. And they kind of look at me like, oh. They didn't always make me feel like I had a worthwhile cause. And one day I just realized what an impact that we had. And it's something that all my life I wanted to do was have an impact on the lives in the world. And
well,
just
it's
helping
true.
All these producers.
I mean, it's true, and it's true of the vanilla people, and it's true of the chocolate people. And it's very important to keep this artisanal wave going that we now have going. Yeah. So you should be congratulated for that.
Here's a last word for you about cheese. This is attributed to General Charles de Gaulle, who took over the government of France sometime in the 1950s or 60s. I forget where it was. And somebody asked him once, why is it so difficult? And he's reputedly said, have you ever tried to govern a country that makes 400 kinds of cheese? And the funny part about it is that's an underestimate.
Yeah, it is. Now, Michelle, do you do anything with, like, well, there are two things. One, I want you to be able to tell our listeners where to get this cheese or how to get it. Is there anything on your website?
There is. We have on the website where to buy, and we try and update it as much as we can. And when we find out that there are shops carrying things, we encourage them to go online and to fill in which cheeses they might have. But it's hard to keep it totally to date. Uh-huh. I mean, a lot of them are located across the country in many, many shops from Whole Foods and Wegmans and Bristol Farms and locally, like in the New York area, to all of the great shops that are there, Murray's and Zabar's and Eli's and just countless wonderful places. You know, every nook and cranny I generally can find. Hopefully, at least one. I've just come up to New London, and they have Drunken Goat in their case, which makes me happy. But I don't always know exactly where everything is.
Right. And do you ever do anything with the American Cheese Society?
All the time.
They're going to be in Pittsburgh. We can meet you.
I know. I will be there.
We're covering it, so we could be in touch before then. And talk about it and get together.
I think that would be great. I will definitely contact you with some ideas I have. But in ACS, we've been doing it for over 15 years, probably, because we know whether it's American cheese or cheese from anywhere else in the world, it's important to always support cheese,
yes.
United in cheese. So even when we could never bring a single cheese there, we just would attend, and then we would do the Festival of Cheese and bring our accompaniments. And a few years ago, when they were looking for ways to earn more money to have the money for scholarships and different things, we kind of started a new trend there. I took a table where I paid for it at the network salon, and I was in the book room for a while, and they allowed me to bring some imported cheese. And then the next year, there were two or three of us, and now there's like all of so many importers who are there showing the imported cheeses on one end, but then it's all about the American cheeses in most of the seminars, and then on the Saturday night where you can see the amazing spread and all the wonderfully talented American cheese producers.
Well, I look forward to actually meeting you in person, and you're a delight to talk to, and I think that you've done a marvel with this company. And hello to Pierluigi.
I will let him know. And I'm so glad that you got all those fantastic cheeses. And for to the Baricato, if you were interested to know, they make that by putting like a four-month-age pepper cheese in a wine barrel, and they seal it so it re-ferments and in pepper. And that's how you get, that's one of my favorite cheeses. Well, one of my favorite cheeses.
That's coming next after we finish the Alassios.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Oh, it's been
really, really fantastic.
Yeah, I'm really excited about getting to meet you. That's great.
I know. I want to work something out. I'll call you offline and ask for your assistance.
Great. So Michelle is Forever Cheese, and is a wonderful company with absolute trove of treasured or to be treasured cheeses available. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, you know, it always pays off to actually have an undisputed undisputed lead as the head honcho of knowledge in a particular niche market. Here we have Laura Pazzaglia, who I guess we were talking, she's in Rome, she lives in Rome, who knows just absolutely everything there is to know about pressure cooking. She does.
There you go. And just in case you're wondering, before you go away, I didn't realize this, and I'm not sure you realized it either, sweetheart, but an Instapot is really a pressure cooker.
It is, exactly.
It's like a pressure cooker on steroids. So it's not an argument between pressure cookers and Instapots. It's a matter of how much you want to spend, I think. Anyway, you'll get
anyhow, but
Laura's got the advice for you. In
the ultimate book on this, called Hip Pressure Cooking, and it's just about everything you need to know about this form of pressure cooking or instant pots or any of these things. Laura Pazzaglia is a cook blogger, I would say, and also now a cookbook author. Is this your first book, Laura?
It's actually my second cookbook. The first one was a collaboration with a small publisher. So.
I see.
But this is the first.
This one
is all my recipes. So.
But this is a very important book that you wrote. This is the hot topic is pressure cooking or what do you call the other ones? Instant pot cooking. And your book is called Hip Pressure Cooking. Hip, meaning, you know, not your old fuddy-duddy stuff from your grandmother and your mother. And it's so thorough. I have the feeling that to ever use one of these devices, I would have to relearn the whole of cooking. Is that true?
Well, pressure cooking is really different from conventional cooking in that it has to be precise. So it's kind of like the difference between regular cooking and baking. Once you have the rules, like, for example, for baking, you have to measure precisely. Once you know exactly what to do and when to do it, it becomes second nature, but you do need to learn those things.
Yeah, well, I have two experiences. I have my mother's pressure cooker, which at one point exploded, and we had spaghetti embedded in the ceiling of the kitchen. Then we had somebody who made equipment, kitchen equipment, and sent me a pressure cooker within the last 5 years to try to make a risotto of all things. And I tried it, and I didn't think it made risotto, and I gave it away.
Damn, we didn't like it. Now, here's a question for you. I can't imagine an Italian nonna cooking with a pressure cooker. Now, how come an author of a pressure cooker book in Italy?
Actually, Italian nonnas in Italy, pressure cookers are more diffused than they are in the United States.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And actually, the Italian nonna in our family, my husband's mother, is still using the same pressure cooker she got when she was married.
Oh, no.
So it's over 55 years old, and she's still using it. And so are all her nonna friends.
Wow.
So actually, Italy is actually the perfect place to be pressure cooking because there's actually a longer, less danger-filled history in Europe of pressure cooking than there is in the United States.
Now, tell us who found it. I was surprised at how early it was invented. And tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, the very first pressure cooker was invented at the end of the Renaissance.
That is so bizarre.
Yeah, but I mean, it didn't take off. People weren't immediately pressure cooking with it. Actually, the technology was then applied to making steam engines because old-type pressure cookers had a wake that was pushed up by the steam. And those are actually still in operation here in Europe. And when it works, it sounds like a piston firing, and there's a reason for that.
Funny.
And that's because it used to fire steam pistons.
Funny. This is so well received, this book, because it is so good, so accurate, so thorough. And I read the advance praise for your book, and they're so impressive, all these people, including, Robert Wang, who is the CEO of I think it's the only maker of Instant Pot, the Instant Pot itself, right?
Yeah.
So,
I've been pressure cooking for almost 15 years, and there was a big learning curve. I made a lot of mistakes. I burned a lot of things. I made a lot of soggy risotto. And my goal with the book was actually to put all my knowledge into the book so that somebody who's picking up the pressure cooker for the first time won't make all the same mistakes I already made.
Well,
that's why there's a big education component to it. Yes, there's obviously recipes and so forth, but the big, what distinguishes this book maybe from what other pressure cooker or instant pot books you might see out there is that there's a big education component to this book as well.
Well, you devote a really large section at the start of your book to how everything works, which is the one thing I think a lot of people don't really understand. They understand that it maybe is faster cooking, but they don't understand exactly why, exactly how, and also something you point out, that not everything really should be cooked in the pressure cooker, although you suggest that many, many, many more things than we use it for should be cooked in the pressure cooker.
Exactly. I kind of try and say, look, it is magical, but it's not magic. So, I mean, long cooking, tough type foods, especially whole grains and legumes that they just sit in the pressure cooker. Their cooking time is shortened. They become tender and delicious. And I've actually done some research. Some of them become more nutritious because the pressure cooker actually breaks these foods down even more before you eat them. And that's what the pressure cooker is great for. But for making egg casseroles or sautéed veggies or chicken breast, that's never going to work. Anything that would just take a couple of minutes in a saute pan to be ready is going to be horribly, horribly overcooked in the pressure cooker. And I see a lot of people out there saying, why is my chicken breast dry? You know, I don't understand. I followed this recipe, not my recipe, but I followed this recipe that I found online, and now I got strings. How can I make it moist again? And the thing is, once meat is overcooked, there's no way to make it under overcooked again. You can't go back.
Right.
So,
Now, Laura, what are the physics? Is it the physics that makes it work? I mean, you say in your book, you explain how it works, but our listeners haven't read the book yet. So how does it actually work?
So what pressure cooking is, and actually what overcooks the chicken breast is, the pressure cooker can't start pressure cooking until there's water boiling inside. And that can take up to 10 minutes. So a chicken breast that would be ready in, 5 minutes in a saute pan, already, even before the cooker starts to pressure cook, the water has to come to boil. It's already 10 minutes, but it's already cooking. So any pressure cooker recipe has to have liquid in it to boil. And so the first part of pressure cooking is just waiting for that liquid to come to a boil. And what that does is it generates steam. The pressure cooker lid is closed, and usually that steam would evaporate from the pot and also reduce the cooking liquids and so forth, but it doesn't evaporate in this case. The cooker is closed tight, and the steam has nowhere to go, and the water keeps generating more and more steam, and it starts pushing on the sides of the cooker and down onto the food, and that is the pressure of pressure cooking. So there's actually some physical pushing by the steam of the food in the cooker, and that actually changes the atmospheric pressure and makes it inside. It changes the atmospheric pressure inside the pressure cooker, and that allows for the water to boil at a higher temperature. Because when you're boiling conventionally, the water boils and that's it. It's not going to get any hotter.
212.
The steam evaporates.
Yeah,
it's not going to get any hotter. But when you're pressure cooking, the temperature of the cooking liquid is going to keep rising until the maximum pressure has been reached. So it will cook the food faster because it's cooking it hotter.
And that's the point at which the pressure cooker explodes.
No, these are safe.
Let me go on, because there's another more modern version that today's all the rage, called an instant pot. Now, is an instant pot the same as a pressure cooker, or is it somehow different?
That's a big undiscovered secret that you will reveal on your show, which is the instant pot is exactly like a pressure cooker. It works exactly like a pressure cooker. It's just like Anne's mom's pressure cooker, but instead of having the flame underneath the stovetop cooker, there's actually a built-in heating element. You can't see it. Instead of you turning on a timer next to it and saying, okay, I have to cook this for 5 minutes, you push the buttons on the front. But the lid, the top, what's going on inside is exactly the same.
Is it really?
Which is why when I...
Okay.
Yeah, it's exactly... It's a lot easier, which, I'm really glad. I'm a big fan of electric pressure cookers because there's a lot less fiddling. And the electric pressure cooker, when Aunt Mom's pressure cooker was getting too hot, mm-hmm. there was no way her mom would know that it's getting too hot, you know? But the Instant Pot has a thermometer, so it's like, oh, it's getting too hot, or the Instant Pot or any electric pressure cooker, and they just turn off the heating element that's inside. So a little bit they're safer, the electric pressure cookers, and they're automated, but they're not just automated that you push in the timer and it goes. They're automated also for the safety systems as well.
Well, now, I wouldn't have, you, from what you wrote in your book, I would have thought you favored the stovetop one because you say that the it's easier, the electric one, but you have more control over the stovetop one.
That's true. I've slowly changed my mind because I've dealt with years and years of people writing to my website, hippressurecooking.com. There's too many variables with stovetops. And what I mean by that is there's a higher learning curve.
That's true.
Because everybody has an induction, an electric, or a gas stovetop, and then the kind of gas. It all gives different number of heat. And a lot of people with a stovetop give up before they even start because they think, oh, my pressure cooker's not working. No, you have to learn how to regulate it, you know, according to your setup. And so that's a big block for many who are just getting started cooking and are, you know, have this big shiny pressure cooker in front of them. They just kind of give up.
Yeah, well, you have so many recommendations.
That's what we did too, by the way.
We gave up. We gave it away.
We gave up and gave it away.
Yeah, I wish I had it back, actually.
The electric pressure cooker, that's the one thing they don't say about pressure cooking, that there is a learning curve even just to use the appliance. So I feel like electric cookers take away there's still a learning curve, but, you know, you can push a button and have something ready. You know, you don't have to learn how to operate it and everything else. So,
well, the one that I had came with the recommendations of you had to keep stopping and stirring anyhow, which is the whole point of risotto taking so much time. So I didn't understand that.
You should have done my risotto recipe.
I saw you have, I checked that immediately to see that you have a risotto recipe and a lot of a rice cooking in here.
The editor actually had to cut it down because I started with 20 risotto recipes, and she's like, look, this is not a risotto cookbook, okay? So save those for another time.
So, but you think it's okay to do risotto then in a pressure cooker?
Yeah, actually, I mean, again, remember what I told you, there's no evaporation in a pressure cooker. So yeah. If you know this and you measure the rice and the broth exactly at the beginning of cooking, then you will get good results. But that's the thing, because we're used to having a big pan of hot broth and stirring it in a little bit at a time and seeing if it's ready. And in the pressure cooker, instead, you throw in the broth all at once, and it has to be the exact right amount, or the rice grains will either burst open and be overcooked, or they'll stick to the bottom and be burned. So,
well, you have so much information in these hip tips you have. It seems to me like you're really trying to protect the consumer here. You tell them what not to do as well as what to do. And there are many things not to do, right? Like overload the pressure cooker.
Well, I sort of, like I said, I try and save people. And whatever tip you see there, what not to do, I've done it. So I've made something that's too spicy, or, you know, I thickened something too much. Whatever it is, if it's in there, what not to do, you can bet that I've made it. So I kind of try to save people from my mistakes, because I think they're common, you know, so.
Well, you know, there are things that you could do with this pressure cooker that you talk about that I would never even envision. And one of them is cooking all these different things in the same pot at the same time. Tell us about these foils, these the little packets.
The foil packets. So the book has a section on multi-level cooking, and basically it takes advantage of the three heat zones in the pressure cooker. And you can cook three different dishes at the same time. So it's actually the opposite of what would be in the oven. Like the hottest heat zone is the base of the pressure cooker. That's where you're boiling something and it's in contact with the heating element or the flame and so forth. That's the hottest part. Then above that, you can add a steamer basket and have a container. And there's food being steamed. So, and then the coolest part happens to be the top, just because of the physical location. But what we're doing is we're wrapping food tightly with foil to keep the steam from getting directly to the food. And so we wrap veggies and so forth in that packet so that it can be cooked slower. So you can actually cook three foods with three different cooking times in that. And I think one of the examples I have is the drunken cowboy chili at the base, cornbread in the middle, and then a packet. Oh, I forgot what I did. Did I do
I can't remember.
Anyway, I put a veggie at the top so that it could cook a little bit slower. And you have all three ready at the same time.
Yeah, no, but some of the things I'm going to have to have some convincing of. Like when you say that the steam itself is tasteless, but then you cook curry in with your brownies?
Yeah. So this is how you can spot a bad pressure cooker recipe. When they say put lots of expensive herbs and spices in the steaming liquid to steam the vegetables to give them flavor. That is absurd because steam is 1/17,000th the concentration of the liquid below. So it's just the flavor is so minimal you can't even detect it. So you can't really flavor the steam in the pressure cooker. So that's why I said you could do a curry with brownies, because really you won't taste the curry on the brownies.
Well, you say that. I mean, I have to try that one. I'm not so sure. I can't imagine why it wouldn't.
Now, first of all, you'll have to get somebody to give you another pressure cooker.
Yeah, right. You know, some of the things, you know, like swordfish, it doesn't take very long to cook. Why would you cook it in a pressure cooker?
Well, a lot of people don't have the equipment to do steaming, and actually since fish and seafood is very delicate, I actually have a tip about slowing down the cooking of fish, because yes, you can end up getting swordfish mince, you know,
yes.
Swordfish shreds if you're not careful. So one of the things I recommend is, actually I recommend two things when using seafood. One is to use low pressure, because pressure cookers come with different pressure levels, low and high. So use low pressure for seafood, and then also cover the seafood. And the seafood could be covered with tomatoes, or it could be covered with, I have Brussels sprouts.
Yeah.
I wanted to do asparagus, but they were out of season. And in Italy, you can't get anything out of season. So in the book, it ended up with Brussels sprouts.
Now, you could also wrap it in foil, right?
Yes, you can also wrap it in foil, but the problem is with seafood, you need to add lemon, and that's acidic, and you don't want that to be in contact with foil. So you have to be a little more careful when you're working.
Yeah, your recipe calls for lemon, you're right. So tell us, I can't get my head around this one either. This book's full of such revelations. You're baking bread in a pressure cooker, your steamed savory white bread.
Yeah, I came up with that recipe. I was contacted by a group of people. There's a whole group of people in the United States that live on their boat full time. And I was talking to the head of one of these groups, and I said, you know, what is the thing that you miss the most about living on a boat? And she's like, I wish I could bake my own bread. You know, but the energy, it takes too much energy. I can't be out in the sea baking bread. It takes, you know, heats up the cabin too much. Just not going to work. So what I did was I came up with this recipe for them based on just old steamed breads. But steamed breads were all sweet. So I kind of, I was inspired to just do kind of a savory steam bread. And, I mean, it's not quite exactly baked, but, you know, it's close enough.
Yeah.
It still gives you the satisfaction of having done something yourself, you know.
Yeah. Well, Laura, I mean, I don't feel like we've done full, I don't think we've really gotten the full impact of this book across our listeners, because there's just so much in it. And, I feel like, if I master this cookbook, I will have learned a whole other course of cooking.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do. I mean, I think it's worth learning, too. What have I missed that you really want people to know about this book?
Well, I want to invite your readers to come to hippressurecooking.com and see sample recipes of the cookbook. And I also have a free video series called Pressure Cooking School, that you can watch, and it'll teach you step by step how to use your pressure cooker.
Now that's genius. I don't know what you're going to do next, but because this is like this is the pinnacle in this whole genre, I think. Again, it's Laura Pazzaglia, and it's Hip Pressure Cooking, Fast, Fresh, and Flavorful. And you can use pressure cookers, and you can also do Instant Pot stuff. And she has fabulously creative recipes. The only thing is, I'm afraid if you get into this book, Laura, you're going to become addicted to doing this.
Well, but there's a lot more to this story that we didn't cover, including the fact that Laura was born in my native land. We never got around to that one, but we must let you go and pressure something.
Yeah, I mean the story about how you got into pressure cooking is also interesting with your baby. And I mean, there's so much in this book, personal and technical and inspirational. Laura, thank you so much, and say hello to Rome for us.
I will. Thank you for having me. Bye bye.
Bye.
Listeners, Anne just asked me if I get it all straightened out, and I think the answer is I got it all straightened out.
A lot of moving pieces and parts to these things.
If it turns out things seem to come to in a different order, just forgive me, and join us again same time, same place next week when I promise I'll get it more organized. I think I have it right, but you never can tell. Anyway, what do we say?
Bye-bye.